take a network break. Drew isn't here today, so I had to bring my own virtual donuts so that Ed Hawley would turn up and I'd have someone to talk to. Welcome to the show, Ed. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
No worries.
It's a little early for me on my side. You dragged me out of bed early.
Well, you should live in a part of the world where it's not early.
I'll move just for the show.
That's it, exactly. Because today's a bit of an unusual day, we're into the dead week ahead of VMworld, where vendors save up their announcements for the conference. And of course, then they release them all in a week, and then we don't get to cover them because there's so much happening. We can't fit them all into a show because we have like a bit of a rule around network breakers. It can't be longer than 45 minutes, which we haven't done yet. It happens every year because obviously, you know, going to a conference run by a competitor or a partner is obviously the only way to get your message out there. Well done, marketing and PR people everywhere. It's like geniuses. What I did this week is got Ed to select most of the top topics for today's show. So it's going to be a different format from usual. There's not a whole lot of enterprise IT news, but Ed's picked up things that he wanted to talk to. But before we get to the news, let's take a moment to introduce our sponsors. Today's show is sponsored in part by InterOptic. InterOptic offers high performance, high quality optics at a fraction of the cost. Been a regular sponsor of the show for a long time and we thank them. You can get on over to interoptic.com and find out more. And today's show is also sponsored by Packet Pushers Ignition. This is our new subscription site. We've talked about it a few times now. Today, it's really just where you can support us. If you've been using our content and you've been really got something from it, maybe you can whip out your corporate credit card and become a member. It's $100 a year. Get the corporate credit card in there and give us some money, and that'll help us to keep bringing this to you every single week. We'll talk more about that down in the show. So the first topic that you picked up here, Ed, was that VMware NSX is leaning into security as a strategy going forward. Less of the networking, more of the security.
Yeah. I thought this was really interesting. And it's the only small amount of lead up, it seems like, going into VMworld. So I figure we might as well talk about it. But NSX, I think there's going to be a whole set of announcements that probably can predict are going to happen through here for the week. NSX is really their key platform they're making most of their revenue off of, and they're going to tip that towards security because security is a hot market. And it's just really talking about, hey, we're going to integrate VeloCloud, we're going to integrate all our security suite. You know, the whole thing's going to sort of come together, and I wouldn't be surprised if you see some pretty significant announcements coming out of VMworld around that.
Well, I hope so, because I think networking is really the growth engine for VMware at the moment. So although VMware vSphere and VMware on AWS and, you know, they've got lots of other things going on, the business unit that's really delivering results for them is the NSX business unit.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And from what I hear, the uptick on VMware Cloud on AWS is not particularly strong. So they need to make sure that NSX is driving that additional business for them.
Mm-hmm. So they recently brought in a new CEO for the NSX business unit, Tom Gillis. Now, Tom Gillis has been in the security industry for a long period of time. And he was originally the CEO of the Cisco security business unit and then went off to do a few years in startups. There was a big purge around about 2011, I think, and he was one of the people, I don't know, it wouldn't be fair to say steered out the door, but there was an exodus of about a dozen senior Cisco executives when there was a house cleaning going on. So now he's coming back from several stints in startups lands, and he's back at NSX. So I guess the security focus is part of a whole strategy from VMware, and they went out looking for somebody to do the security stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of executives over in the NSX BU now, so I'm not surprised that they're gonna do this. There's gonna be everything, you know, every single portion of NFV is gonna fit around NSX. So that's really the strategy going forward. I wouldn't be surprised if we see some additional stitching announcements for things like load balancing and a bunch of other stuff that might extend their ecosystem there too.
Well, they're already doing load balancing. They're doing layer 3, L3, L4 load balancing, and they already look a lot like Istio, like a service mesh, like what Istio is.
Yeah, I meant more along the lines of like, hey, we might actually do some integration with Istio to make things interesting for everyone else so that we get some sort of play in Kubernetes that looks a little better than what's going on today.
Yeah, they're a little bit shut out of Kubernetes, although PKS is looking very interesting, and there's some VMware employees are actually the release captain for the upcoming release of Kubernetes, I believe. So it's not like they're hostile, they're definitely involved and engaged, so it's not like they're standing back. But I think the real interesting part here is going to be, although micro-segmentation is a big deal for NSX, and obviously in the SD-WAN, they're going to bring that out to the edge, application recognition then to qualify apps to flow into micro-segments. I think the secret's going to be identity. So Cisco's got its ISE, and then they bought Duo Security to boost up its identity management. Aruba's got ClearPass. I think identity management is the big piece that they're missing. Without that, you really don't have a micro-segmentation strategy. You can do application steering all you like, but I think identity is really the future.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, especially in terms of what's going on cloud and distributed cloud platform, and they're saying, you know, with NSXT, it's got to, you know, we can run it anywhere. you're going to need something that actually solves that problem of both deploying the service, but then also managing it over the long haul. And identity helps you to do that.
I guess Cisco's also got its VPN client into things like iOS, and you know they have an Android version as well, whereas I don't know if VeloCloud has that yet. That's really where it is these remote smartphones are actually the edge for a lot of companies.
Yeah, I'm not aware of anything from VeloCloud in that particular area, so yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if they try to branch out a little bit. I haven't heard any rumors around that, but you know, hey, keep your ears to the ground for VMworld.
Yeah, I'm just sort of saying, you know, if you're steering into a security strategy, the two things that are missing is obviously the person edge. Like the edge isn't the branch, it's the person. And the smartphone is you could be anywhere, and you could be accessing the legacy, you know, the existing data center, the on-prem data center, or you could be into somebody's off-prem cloud, you know, AWS or Azure.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with them playing in the client endpoint arena either. Yeah. So like, you know, the Cylance, Carbon Black, and et cetera, the rest of the folks that are in that space. So,
but VMware's got the thin client thing going on.
Yeah.
Which could be welded into this,
Horizon,
I think.
Horizon, is it?
Yeah, Horizon, yeah. So yes, NSX is definitely steering squad security. We've seen that. We've talked about that on the show many times, so I agree with you. I'm not 100% sure that putting the screws on Cisco, as this article from Light Reading says, it's a good title, but I don't think it's actually that. Cisco, of course, has been boosting its security strategy with various acquisitions over the last few years and very much working into applications and in their financial results, which we'll talk about at the end of the show for people who get bored by that. Security business lit up by like 10% or more. So Cisco is in a good position. The second item that you put on the show roster was that Carl Icahn discloses positions in VMware and the VMware tracking stock worth $500 million.
Yeah, I was really surprised by this. I didn't think that they would have someone that had a single block that was that large. I mean, that's, what did they say, 2.1% stake in VMware at the end of June? That's a big chunk of money. So apparently he is incredibly bullish around the whole tracking stock valuation and what's going to flip back in for Dell.
He's more of a predator, though, isn't he? He tends to take short-term arbitrage positions.
Yeah, I figure this is a short term. He knows something, you know, he predicts that something's going to be happening in terms of the swallow up and roll back, and that he's going to do well there. But I was still surprised that it was that large. I mean, most of the folks, and you figure it's going to be bigger cap firms that are doing their investments and things along those lines.
Was he betting on Dell using VMware as a listing vehicle?
Yeah, I really think it's just one of those plays, just to sort of, you know, this is pure finance play. This has nothing to do with the technology, but it was just more of an interesting observation that someone had just gone that big in. So either, you know, he had a nice meal with Michael and sat down and said, hey, I need some big uplift.
He tends to go hostile as much as he's friendly.
I don't think it's one way or the other in terms of anything that they would know, but it was just an interesting position set going into VMworld. You know, I'd be even more interested if he showed up and then harassed, but
yeah. Well, Icahn's always good for headlines. So when he invests in something, he tends to be fairly robust in the press, which is always tends to expose information that we haven't otherwise heard. NetApp is about to launch a VMware private cloud reference architecture. This is an article from CRN. I can't wrap my mind around this. NetApp isn't hyperconverged. Is it selling servers and a HCI platform itself? And at the same time, is it selling storage with Cisco and HPE and Hitachi?
Yeah, most folks don't realize that NetApp actually has an HCI solution now. So I guess they're more than a storage company, but no one thinks of them as other than a storage company. But they've got their whole VMware private cloud reference now for folks to be able to utilize. And I thought this was one of those small bits of news that came out before VMworld in terms of NetApp trying to get ahead of the news cycle, obviously. But you know, they've got their whole solution set around HCI and what they're putting together. So they went ahead and sort of launched it out. I don't know how many folks are actually keeping track of that app anymore. It seems like they've really fallen off the radar for most folks. I think the last announcement I saw with them was the stuff with NVIDIA around the DGX platform and building a competitor to Ari that the Pure Storage and NVIDIA released out together. You know, NetApp got on board and finally got a platform for basically ingesting data quickly into the NVIDIA DGX stuff. This is good news. I mean, there's something there for NetApp to actually hang their hat on.
Could customers literally turn over their HP or their Cisco UCSs or their Dell servers to buy NetApp servers? Is that a tough ask?
Yeah, well, I don't think that's really the ask. I think the ask is, hey, we've got a good HCI solution offering. You're already buying NetApp. Why don't you just pick up a few of these to be able to just manage through and get a converged play, which is the same converged play that Cisco is doing. And,
yeah,
you know, don't buy net new and pick up, you know, whatever HCI vendor you're picking up, everyone's got something to put on the plate there. You know, NetApp's got something, so they're not left out of the equation.
So really what you're doing is you've got a storage array, you put a VMware private cloud software on top, and there's a bunch of white label servers underneath it. doesn't seem like a whole huge value add, but if you're really all in with NetApp, then it gives you a way forward. If you're in with NetApp and VMware, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that's unique about NetApp, I will mention, is that, you know, NetApp's got their NetApp Cloud Volumes, which is NFS and SIFS, which extends to AWS, GCP, and Azure. So if you're a NetApp shop and you've made those investments to extend NetApp capabilities into those three cloud providers that way, so you're using NetApp on AWS, NetApp on GCP, and NetApp on Microsoft Azure, you can fully integrate this all together, and the HCI platform doesn't care, and it's going to distribute and do all the stuff correctly for you in terms of at least getting your data sets moved out there, which has value, and there's value definitely in there. So, you know, I always considered NetApp to be the company that was like, you know, they did the software side really, really well for what they were doing. You know, and they just happened to build hardware, and they finally got around to pushing out their software release out into the public cloud. And that's where I saw the interest in the story. It's like, hey, I got an HCI on-prem platform. I've got something that's a little better in terms of integrating into the public clouds. There's a story there because they're multi-cloud. And so there's something a little bit more interesting versus maybe what Cisco is doing with HyperFlex, which is really only a GCP arrangement right now. You don't see that sort of extensibility across the board.
But I didn't get the impression that GCP was a HyperFlex. They're not deploying Kubernetes on top of HyperFlex, are they? They're just using a nominated set of UCS hardware and deploying Kubernetes natively.
No, you can use the HyperFlex platform with Kubernetes on it. It's a pre-bundled package, and they're managing that together. So you're getting Kubernetes on the HyperFlex platform, and then you don't have to worry about any of those managed resource requirements, and Kubernetes just does the right stuff.
So you don't have to worry about storage or compute resources. Right. It's all managed by the HyperFlex HCI layer, and then Kubernetes runs on top of that.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and that's the transformation that you get in terms of being able to push that up into GCP very easily, is because it's just that need of Kubernetes. They spent the time to integrate and make that easier, which is good. I mean, that's good for customers.
Well, we don't have it in the show notes, but Nutanix was talking about its Google Cloud tie-up as well, and that it's going to be doing Google GKS on-prem as well.
Right. Yeah, that's not a surprise. I wouldn't be surprised because it's actually something that Nutanix can do directly themselves.
Yeah, and Nutanix, of course, being Nutanix, said, and we're using Google Cloud as an accessory to our Nutanix HCI platform.
Of course. Yeah. Of course, because you always have to leave with Nutanix first. So
Nutanix is one of those companies that only sees what it wants to see and only has very definitive ways of talking about what it does. I just thought this NetApp thing was fairly interesting because it sort of had flowed under the radar, and I'm just wondering how many companies would embrace a HCI solution from NetApp, which would involve, you know, moving away from the traditional service suppliers. People seem to be incredibly loyal to those branded servers with their Mystic Magic Source inside, and I can't quite understand why. It does strike me as a triumph of marketing, not a triumph of technology.
Well, maybe it comes around the other way, where this puts some power back in the procurement team's hands around some of these bigger companies that says, you know what, it's just easier to deal with a single vendor to get certain market motions done and discount prices negotiated, and I don't have to deal with as many folks.
I think this is one of these things where sales needs to make sure the competitors don't get in there. Like, once upon a time, the storage company had the storage, the server company had the server, and the networking had the networking, and never the twain shall meet, and they all stayed. But now with hyperconverged, it's, you know, and if NetApp is going head-to-head with, you know, with HPE in terms of HPE wants to sell its hyperconverged array, it has to have its own product to compete. I think this is just straight up sales action, not actually a value add at all.
Yeah, to be competitive in market. I wonder if it's also maturity for NetApp, I guess, in many ways. So
I'd see it as, you know, if you're not with me, you're against me. So if I'm into a customer who's a NetApp customer, and then suddenly HPE says you should throw your NetApp out and replace it with SimpliVity or 3PAR, you know, whatever the storage is called this week, then I'll go in and say, you should throw your HPE out and give me a competitive position that works.
Yeah, someone's got to compete with Dell on that upper end. I mean, they own so much of the storage market today in terms of, you know, both the acquisition and what they had in-house, and then being eroded from the downstream side from Pure Storage and what Pure was able to do in the market. I think that's a big challenge for NetApp as of late. And
yeah, they're kind of being isolated. You can't be a storage company anymore, because that's why EMC sold out to Dell, because the end was nigh. Speaking of the end being nigh, this is not the case for Cisco, which is increasingly becoming a software company. The theme here is that in a recent video, you actually selected a few videos in today's show notes. The Bloomberg video talks about the fact that Cisco is the 19 of the last 20 acquisitions were actually software companies, not hardware.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting point. Chuck actually made that directly as sort of in a comment back and forth. They were like, hey, their entire acquisition strategy that Chuck's put together is really about picking up software companies. And I've said this privately for a bunch of folks. I've been talking with a lot of people. We've chatted at conferences in the past. I'm like, look, yeah. They're going all in on software. It's 100%. They've changed over their sales teams. I mean, like everything. I thought it was really interesting that the rest of the market's picking up on this, right?
The sales teams aren't being revenued on selling hardware anymore. They're only really being revenued on, like, that's not entirely true, of course, but they get extra credit or extra sales bonuses for selling software and subscriptions, and they get less for selling hardware than before. And, you know, the salespeople are struggling with that because a lot of customers don't want to do the software and they're caught in a difficult situation. I've had a lot of people saying to me, the sales rep wants to sell me this, but that's not what we're asking for. And the sales rep is like, no, 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 you have to buy that. And some customers are actually walking away, you know.
I didn't need to make my quota.
Yeah, that's right.
It's one of those where definitely with Cisco One, with the services and, you know, things like Umbrella for wrapping everything together. The nice thing about selling that way, and the nice thing actually for the customer that way, is that as they add capabilities to each one of those sort of product bundles that you pick up, so whether that's a One or whether that's something like Umbrella, if they add features to Umbrella, you just get them as things move on, which is much more in line with things like how Microsoft Office 365 or Microsoft 365 are sold, right? You start getting enhancements and capabilities that are put in there. It means you're less likely to do the next set of motions, which is like, oh, well, if I get that as a service here, I'm less likely to go check out a single point vendor who might solve that particular problem for me. And I think Cisco is really trying to make sure that everyone stays in their ecosystem in terms of that software and selling motion.
Well, we saw that last week, where they announced that Viptela would run on the existing hardware. So most ASR, ISRs would run. So customers don't have to go out and test the market, right? Because they don't have to replace the hardware, they don't have to test the market. So they don't have to evaluate competitive solutions. Viptela is nominally just an upgrade. It's a very carefully calculated move to say SD-WAN isn't a product, it's a feature. And so we'll just make it a feature on our routers, which is...
Exactly. And it's software, right? I mean, it was software. Everyone, I'm sure, probably maybe thought it was a hardware sale, but that was really a software sale. And just being able to put that software on the ISRs, how many ISRs are there? Probably
a million odd, yeah.
A million, 100,000 that they can push this stuff out to, probably a million or more.
They mentioned a million or more in the presentation of existing routers out there that they can now go and upgrade, in inverted commas. But I released a YouTube video this week talking about this that's on the Ignition for members, where really you would be better off with a modern appliance than a legacy ASR-ISR platform. Those boxes that Cisco make in the ASR-ISR are so extensively customized that they're not very good x86 servers, if you know what I mean. I'm not saying they're broken or they're bad. They're just, it'd be much more simpler and less technical debt if they were just straight up x86 boxes than these highly customized boxes that Cisco wants to produce.
Well, I think the good news for customers are, though, that they can tip and get the software to run there. And then as whatever upgrade cycle they need to do over that time, if Cisco either offers them something better in a more generic fashion, they can go ahead and get that deployed. If not, you know, you've at least got some protection to be able to get those features and functionalities, which is entirely what Cisco is after, right?
Yeah.
You know,
they want to Meraki-ize the enterprise, except Meraki will be for SME, SMB. And then the Viptela is a platform to do a Meraki version because they have the cloud controller and everything. So I think you'll see ACI be folded into that cloud, the vManage platform that they've got, and the DNA center will be folded into, they'll build out that cloud somewhere or another, whether it's folded into vManage or whether vManage folds into something else or they develop it ground up, but that will be where Cisco will be, and you'll rent your platform. The reason being largely is for sales. They want to know everything that your network is doing so that the salesperson can go and look at your network and then turn up on site and go, oh, I see you've been decommissioning devices. Why is that?
Yeah. I don't know if they're that nefarious, maybe.
So that's a big reason for doing it. That's what they do. Yeah. That's why Oracle's getting into the cloud.
I think the other thing that's really interesting and part of the software strategy is they've been doing this to their partners too. So if you sit down and talk to them, DNA Center is a good example. You know, they've gone out to the partner community and said, you're going to make your money by extending and making DNA Center extensible. You should be investing in software development to do that. All their partners are being told that basically that's where your investment has to be. So I think this just dovetails and reinforces yet again, and the street recognizing that same.
I agree. But Cisco as a software company is still related to enterprise IT infrastructure. So just because they bought AppDynamics for $3.2 billion, it's still a piece of infrastructure. It's software infrastructure that monitors apps. So if a customer has an app, they would go and buy an AppDynamics license to monitor the performance of that app that they're creating, you know, they're DevOpsing the heck out of. So it's not like, you know, Cisco suddenly building databases or cloud platforms. They're actually building infrastructure tooling. So they're staying true to their message, but as you say, 19 out of 20. Moving along, NVIDIA has just published its results and then suddenly finds that crypto mining and crypto technology isn't doing what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, the only reason this is really interesting is everyone, you know, talking about sort of what's going on in the sort of crypto mining space and the fact that they were starving out for game chips all over the place. And I just thought it was interesting that they actually had a formal acknowledgement in terms of the market share and what was going on of realizing that the gaming and data center businesses are two different things within their chip platform. And then within the gaming platform, there's this whole sort of subset around sort of crypto and what's driving for crypto mining. And I sort of thought of it as the interesting sort of like, hey, have we reached a tipping point where maybe crypto mining isn't having the same impact on NVIDIA as it was before, that really it's part of that business is dying off, or at least the home market for crypto mining seems to be reached the longer portion of the tail.
It'll be interesting to see how it works out. I mean, we were using GPUs for crypto mining, but people have pretty quickly started to custom develop chips for crypto mining. So, you know, why would you use a GPU unless you've got a lot of variants? Once things start to stabilize, you don't need a general purpose processor. You want a specific processor.
Exactly.
But I looked up some of NVIDIA's financial results, and they said that 62% of NVIDIA's revenue has been driven by the top 18 cloud and OEM IP customers. So it's really quite focused on the data center.
Yes. Yeah. And I think the other thing that's really interesting is, at what point does NVIDIA decide that they just need to split what the company is doing, right? And I mean, it's, to me, it doesn't make any sense in terms of like, you're either into the AI machine learning space or you're into making graphics chips, right? They need to start specializing in one area or the other, otherwise they'll get leapfrogged, because what Google's doing with TensorFlow and the TP3, and they're really focusing on that data center space around machine learning and AI.
Yep.
NVIDIA's just stamping out the same core set of capabilities, and granted, they're quite complementary, but at some point...
Yeah, but we've seen a lot of companies develop their own silicon. So Google's got TensorFlow mm-hmm. now, and they've got multiple versions of that silicon. They've got one that works at the edge, low powered, you know, very small chip, very small thermal envelope, as well as the big hot ones that they run in the data center. NVIDIA could be blindsided by customers just developing their own silicon. Like, as Amazon, Facebook, Google would happily spend, you know, a couple of hundred million to get a competitive advantage instead of going and paying NVIDIA for the privilege.
Yeah, and I think the other thing with NVIDIA is, at least at my opinion, is that they look like they're taking on some of the challenges that are actually really hard in the machine learning and AI space. So I think the good news for them is that they're trying to address some of the problems that are hard for the industry overall, which is really, there's tons of data out there, but it's not particularly well structured.
And this is where AI self-training, self-learning, instead of structured data, unstructured data, and then unstructured data, which is automatically analyzed. Moving on, AT&T faces a $224 million lawsuit over cryptocurrency theft. This is to do with people social engineering your telco so they can intercept your SMS messages, and then somebody was able to steal a whole bunch of cryptocurrency.
Yeah, I just thought that was really surprising that was even a thing, number one. And it was follow on from the fact that, you know, the drop off from crypto mining. So I just thought that was a sort of interesting add on to sort of say like, hey, people are still stealing stuff out there in the crypto mining space, and that AT&T is actually facing a lawsuit in regards to that.
Yeah, and for big money too, because the theft was quite substantial. They took 24 million worth of cryptocurrency. So even if he only gets his 24 million back, he'll be happy. I think the interesting thing here is that hackers are realizing that it's actually worthwhile to subvert employees in telcos.
Yeah, I was really that was the other thing, is that this looked pretty targeted, and it was definitely something that not any novice is going to be doing. But it's definitely worth a note that in terms of maybe AT&T, Verizon, the rest are going to have to step up what they do in terms of protecting, you know, for end user consumer, how that works out. So expect to see a heck of a lot more probably two factor and multi-factor configurations.
Having worked at a telco?
Well, at least coming down to the customer, I don't know.
Having worked at a telco, there is no way that SMS is safe or secure. I mean, let's leave SS7 aside as well, which is easily hackable. You know, you can generate, with enough SS7, you can generate your own SMS.
Yeah, I don't know if it'll force them to pick up some third party, you know, two factor, you know, what Duo or Okta or others were doing in terms of that space and making it a better messaging.
The carrier networks are not secure. They're just not. The assumption is that MPLS networks are secure and safe because you're running in a micro segment, right? They're not safe. They're not well protected. They're not defended. They're just assumed to be safe because you can't prove otherwise.
You can't prove otherwise because you don't get to run it.
You can't see it, and nobody. That's a problem for another day. Oracle continues on its insecure ways. It's almost legendary just how insecure Oracle products are at this point. how long patches take to arrive, and let's face it, how difficult they are to install. A vulnerability was discovered in the Java VM component of the Oracle database server itself. This has a CVSS score of 9.9. In other words, happy days for hackers.
Yeah, I was just like, oh, wow, this isn't good news for Oracle, on top of the fact that they, you know, sort of misstated on some of their public cloud earnings. And then you go around and say, like, hey, all of the stuff that we would want to run on our public Oracle cloud is going to have structural problems. At least they'll patch it for you. So maybe that's good news. So it's like one of those things that takes the cake. And on previous shows, you guys have mentioned over and over again, right? the bundling and problems for Oracle. So I'm not too surprised.
I do wonder how they're going to handle all this in their own cloud. If they bring their insecure software onto them, and then they actually assuming liability, because once you're running the service, you actually have liability. You're assuming liability for keeping that service safe and secure. They're going to have a difficult time securing a lot of their software, because normally that responsibility rests with the customer, not with the vendor.
Yeah, well, you would hope that Oracle would actually have a better way to actually support and run that in the public cloud side. So, you know, if you're optimistic, you're saying that they're going to handle this for you and they're going to do a great job. If you're pessimistic, you're going to be like, it's going to be just as bad for me there, but at least
there's
they have
no
to
signs
own the
that Oracle takes. I mean, in the time that, you know, we've been doing this, you've never seen Oracle take security seriously. Why would it suddenly start?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a struggle for struggle for everyone. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, it's a struggle for everyone to do security well, but it seems like Oracle just is truly struggling in this particular arena.
You talked about Remedy Street.
There was the one piece that I thought was interesting too, is that, you know, Remedy Street has been accused of stealing Oracle's intellectual property. They've been trying to get out of the business. They do third-party support around Oracle.
Oh, third-party enterprise software support services, including Oracle, right?
Right, and specifically Oracle around the Oracle database. And they've been sued for a long time by Oracle in terms of claiming intellectual property theft. A judge actually agreed with them, so I thought that was sort of an interesting set. I imagine that will extend on and drag on for a lot longer.
Once you're into Oracle forever. There's no way to escape, and it looks like the law is on Oracle's side at this point in time. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure they're going to go pound their chest on that one and say you should be buying Oracle support versus buying third party.
In fact, you've got no choice. We're going to sue you if you don't. Another Intel CPU vulnerability this week, another attack on speculative execution, which actually looks worse than the earlier ones. Possibly even more importantly is the patches for these speculative execution problems seem to cause substantial, I mean serious, like 80% performance drops on x86 servers.
Yeah, the good news is they got this out a little bit earlier than the last patch. So a lot of folks are patched around the automatic updates that everyone will go through on the major cloud providers. But yeah, this was pretty serious. I mean, I don't know if this is going to be something that actually impacts Intel sales over a long period of time because of just what is going to happen.
The Intel share price is unmoved by this announcement. Fundamentally, we've discovered a security vulnerability that makes x86 secure CPUs from Intel fundamentally unfit for purpose. But I don't see anybody talking about suing Intel for unsafe practices or it's very strange here that how Intel seems to have gotten away with this, in a sense. Like, none of it seems to stick to them.
None of it seems to stick. I don't know if this is one of those things where what they have pre-built in their contracts about what their partners can and can't say might impact potentially some of it. And certainly, I doubt most folks want to go out early in the gate and talk about how poor their relationship is with Intel when they don't have great amount of
alternatives. Yeah. Where are you going to go?
Well, I mean, you could hit AMD, right? Yeah. And they have partially some of the same structural issues in regards to just that it's x86, and that's not going to change too much in terms of instruction set. But I think it's more of how is Intel really going to, you know, redress for customers what's actually happening here. You thought you were buying one thing at one performance level. They released three sets of patches and you now have something substantially less than what you bought before. I don't think most customers are going to be happy with that. So it's, how does this actually work, and how do they make people whole, or do they just not care and it's just move forward as quickly as possible onto the next chip and see if they can get people to move past it?
Tencent, the Chinese cloud company, has recorded strong growth, but profit slipped.
Yeah, profit slipped. And I thought this was important to sort of realize that even though the growth of all the public clouds is just, you know, phenomenal, that they're still slipping on things which is really important to the bottom line, which is the profit side. There's strategies that are specific around some of the public clouds of giving up profit for, you know, growth, and that's fine. But Tencent wasn't really on record of saying that was a part of their goal. And I think some of it was really, you know, around the gaming side for them because they do a huge amount of the gaming import into the Chinese market.
Yes.
And not getting that stuff sort of taken care of was a hit on their profit side. Not necessarily their growth side, but their profit side.
Yeah, their revenue still grew by 30% or something abnormal, like just outnormous.
Yeah.
But their profits didn't grow as much as people. So I think they grew like 20% instead of 30% or whatever the number is. So what you're saying is this a sign that bigger clouds might be reaching their maximum growth? That's a viable thing. Well, let's take a moment to thank our sponsor for today, Interoptic. Interoptic is a data interconnect company. They make SFP optical modules so that you can drop them into your 5G, IoT, 4K video or any other high bandwidth activity, and you need to have good optics to do that. If you're not doing optics correctly, you are going to pay for it later. Interoptic understands that you're going to need a more nimble layer zero, and they have a full range of products that you need today and the ones you don't yet know you'll need tomorrow. That is, you might be doing 10 gig today, but there's 25, 50, and 100 gig just around the corner. So stop paying OEM prices for optics and start talking to optics experts who deliver brand equivalent transceivers at a fraction of the price. You don't need to buy optics from your switch maker. You can just buy them from somebody else. Don't be fooled by lesser optics. Don't just buy the cheapest. The difference between generic third party and brand equivalent optics does matter. In the same way as when you used to buy your memory directly from the server maker, and then pretty quickly we all learned to start buying OEM memory from, say, companies like Kingston and so forth, this is exactly the same business. You can purchase the same, if not better, performing optics designed by engineers who truly understand what you need at a fraction of the cost, and then they can support them for you. So if you, even if you have, you know, Cisco, HPE, or Dell switches, you can get Interoptic SFP modules, drop them straight into your switches, and they will support them in those switches. So get your optics from a company that spends a lot of time thinking about just optics instead of worried about software and switches, and you'll get something. And as your network gets more complex, you'll want to work with optics experts who know how to troubleshoot those problems when the light in the optic goes out. Thanks very much to Interoptic for sponsoring the Packet Pushers. Check out their website at interoptic.com. Well, back to the news. The US is finally getting some chip and signature on its financial transactions. And you wanted to raise this issue because you're sort of a bit frustrated that why does the US suck at this?
Yeah. Well, I just got back from Europe. I did a big tour with a family through Europe. And you know, your guys' experience of just security-wise and what going through purchases is so much better than what we have here. But the first time we rolled out the sort of classic, like we have to make a decision, we chose to do chip and signature, which just on the technical difference, right? It doesn't actually require a PIN to actually do the transaction. It just requires a...
Well, when I go to the US and put my... I have a US credit card associated with Packet Pushers, and the fact I don't have to type in a PIN number baffles me. it's like anybody who nicks that card can just go to town.
Yeah. It's the exact same problem we had before. It's just we feel like we made an improvement. What was worse about it, I think more than anything, is it wasn't that much more better than the swipe card stuff that we were doing before, but the transactions were taking forever. So for all of us in the US who sat there forever in the line, I can't tell you how long the line started getting just doing day-to-day things like grocery shopping and just waiting for your chip.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So even though you had chip and PIN, that was taking 10 or 20 seconds for the approval for the...
Yeah, for the actual transaction to go through. It was so painful. Well, you know, Square finally made an announcement for everything around the performance improvements for all of their customers, which is significant because a lot of small to medium businesses here, which is most shops, you know, are using things like Square here in the US. And
so some interesting things here. The US market for banking is quite unique in that consumers actively resist any move to modernize payments. Did you know that? And in particular, the Americans love cash. So large parts of the US actually don't want to use electronic transactions. They just love cash. And it's a real problem here.
We can stuff it in our mattress easier.
Yeah. I've got a link to an article here saying half of Americans are resisting the move to frictionless payments because they'd prefer to use cash. They think that privacy and security is, you know, with banks is a problem. So one of the interesting things here is that in the UK, and also I know in Australia, is that cash actually costs them so much money to move around, to account for it and track it, that they actually decided it was just a business they didn't want to be in. And so they all formed a joint venture, which is a non-profit that all the banks own. And that non-profit, it literally ships the cash around the country and handles all the cash. That's all it does. So no, the banks don't own, you know, the armored cars or any of that sort of stuff. There's literally a company that does nothing but move money around to where it needs to be. The goal of the banks is actually to stop having cash because they don't want that business. It's a loss-making business.
Yeah, well, it's a loss-making business here in the United States, but we love our cash, right?
Apparently so. I'm kind of pleased in a way because when I travel there, I do pay for most of my stuff in cash. because the foreign currency exchange transactions are a total ripoff, but that's a problem for another day. The FCC, moving on. The FCC court says it made an error in the approval of the AT&T Time Warner merger.
Yeah. When was the last time you heard something like this? Where basically, one of our public institutions that's responsible for managing and controlling stuff that happens on airwaves in the U.S. and for internet access basically comes out and says that the courts messed up and should have changed the opinion around what they're doing. It's just, obviously one side of our government barking at another, but I still think it's important because it sets the tone about what else could come down.
Yeah, the FCC has really been pro-business. They've been cheering on.
Oh, yeah.
And Ajit Pai has seemed to be like an extension of the right-wing party over there, very pro-business and pro-merger, pro-big business particularly. But in this case, the Department of Justice appealed against the AT&T Time Warner merger again after losing the first phase. And now the FCC seems to have come out in the Department of Justice's case in the U.S., against it. And of course, that's not great for AT&T or Time Warner, because if they have to roll back, it's going to be real trauma. So if you're interested about that, head on over to rsstechnica.com. In the show notes, you can find out more about it. I think the most interesting part about this is that the actual suggestion here is that AT&T just outright lied in some parts of this.
Yeah, it's sort of a bold statement in there, but we'll leave that for others to yeah. sort of
read the article and see what you think. The district court erred when, anyway, whatever. Some new silicon, a 5G modem chip from Samsung, seems to offer an alternative to Qualcomm. I think this is really interesting, a modem chip to go into smartphones. It would be quite a kick in the face. We've talked a lot about Qualcomm here on the Network Break and how it's having a difficult time, like Apple's refusing to use Qualcomm's chips. And if Samsung's got one, this might be where Apple's heading.
Yeah, and I think it's important because this, Samsung is a supply chain for a tremendous number of their competitors in addition to themselves. Does this consolidate even more what's happening in the market around what Samsung's providing, which clearly they're able to do that side of the business very well. They're able to sell to their competitors and do stuff for themselves and seem like to not have a conflict there. But wow, I mean, like, talk about just securing your own supply chain and making sure you don't have to deal with Qualcomm or some others. I think it's a pretty bold move on their part, probably great from them from a manufacturer supply side. So I keep an eye on it. And if it starts catching on, I wouldn't be surprised to hear some rumblings about how that's going to play out in the long term for the mobile market.
I didn't get time to look up what Qualcomm's share price was doing and whether this has been impacting them. But on the face of it, this probably would impact them, because if that chipset starts to get traction and it's a 5G modem, then the 5G networks aren't here yet. Qualcomm does seem to have a market-leading 5G modem itself to go inside of smartphones. So having an alternative is going to be good. Intel seems to be fading out from this market too. So it does leave a lot of space for somebody to enter that market. So, if Samsung's got one, Arm's also doing something in this space as well. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out. Cisco Duo, its head sales honcho, the chief sales officer or chief revenue officer, whatever the fancy name they've got for this person, isn't staying around after the merger. He's already walked out the door.
Yeah, I don't see this as a huge thing, but I think it's just sort of interesting side note, mainly because, Cisco's got a huge sales organization, so they'll be able to absorb what the Duo team is doing and be able to probably extend and accelerate what Duo is doing from a sales basis. But, hey, everyone takes their own chance, and I'm sure he got plenty way out that door. So I don't think that's a big deal, but it's just sort of interesting as a side note to say, like, hey, the gentleman who's running sales for them and probably a chunk of sales strategy for them is moved on. But I'm sure that, Cisco's not going to have any difficulty getting all that transition.
I've heard several people say who worked for companies that were acquired that working for Cisco sales is not very appealing to them. They felt that working in the Cisco product management wasn't as satisfying.
Well, you're certainly not going to have the same impact, right? So you're not going to have the same impact on the team. So, hey, you're small. You're going to be a small to medium-sized fish in a very, very big pond.
It can be a nice holiday for some people. He's actually going to a company called Luminate.io. And what's interesting about that is it's a zero trust access product, which is, in other words, an identity management product for cloud access, which is all the fashion right now. And it goes back to what we said at the top. It's all about identity management, which is actually the big key, I think. So probably a good move.
Yep.
Let's take another break and just talk about Packet Pushers Ignition. It's our new membership site called Ignition. You can find it at ignition.packetpushers.net. It's got free and paid membership tiers. So once you're a member, there's a whole bunch of free stuff, including our link propagation newsletter, a human infrastructure magazine, and you'll also be subscribed to get emailed in your inbox about the latest podcasts that we've published on Packet Pushers and all of our blog posts and news articles that we push out pretty constantly throughout the week. And it's also our site, which we're going to be building to help drive your professional development. We're going to be publishing videos and ebooks and blogs coming up. But today, what we're asking you to do is, if you want to sign up, if you've ever felt that you just wanted to support the packet pushers, if we've been helpful to you and your career progression, this is your chance to contribute something back to us. Sign up. It's $100 for a year. You can become a member, and then we'll start producing content in there that can help you progress your career. So give you information, get you think about it. And to that end, I wrote a book, which is sort of collected career advice. It's a unique sort of a book. It's advice targeted to people who are working in enterprise IT infrastructure. And it's my take on how you can become more entrepreneurial about your career, how you can start owning your career and your profession so that you need to understand how to adapt in the changing environment. Like enterprise IT, as we already talked about today, companies like Cisco are moving away from their traditional business models into new ones. That's a warning that you need to be thinking about doing the same. So get on over to ignition.packetpushers.net. Check it out. Sign up for the free membership. And if you want to support us, maybe you'd like to sign up for the paid subscription, and then that'll help us to get that off the ground and get the content into the pipeline. Thanks very much. Cisco published its results this week, and we always tend to dive a little bit into it. It's the second last article for this week, so hold with me while we go through it. Cisco had a bang-up quarter, just absolutely bang-up quarter, 6% up by revenue, their biggest quarter ever in history at $12.8 billion. So pretty amazing results.
Yeah, pocket change, right? I couldn't believe that they really pulled it across the finish line and certainly crushed it. I think their whole discussions around, you know, helping customers solve with multi-cloud and the Google partnership and their security offerings and just really heading and executing on their software subscription and support models really seem to just be where things are going. And I don't know if you cover through some of the numbers or in regards to where they're at right now, but you know, 12.8 billion in a quarter is just a pretty staggering number for Cisco to pull through.
It is staggering considering that they were declining fairly steadily in revenue for a long period of time, like for 4 or 5 years, to suddenly turn around, but not by a little bit, but by 6% is just astonishing.
Yeah, you know, we're in the age of Chuck now, so.
Yeah. I must say, when I watched the video with Chuck in it, he was looking pretty comfortable and fairly smug.
Yeah, he was looking very happy, didn't he?
He was, wasn't he? You know, I was like handling off the softballs and just looking pretty smug about the whole thing. They saw 11% growth in the enterprise, which is, I think, surprising. I think enterprise has been declining fairly substantially. So maybe enterprises have decided that the changes that Cisco have made, Uncle Chuck would call it innovation. I'd call it like selling the same products as everybody else, but it's Cisco and people like that. So the software-defined access he particularly called out, he said that they've got over 9,500 customers of the Catalyst 9000. Considering that product's barely a year old, that's quite extraordinary. And the Viptela SD-WAN already has 800 customers. He called that out in the analyst transcript that I read. And already now, more than half of software revenue is subscription. So that is, the software revenue is already been switched over from buy it, own it, to 56% of it, of that revenue is now already subscription. So we talked earlier about sales, Cisco sales reps being revenued on their ability to close deals with subscriptions in them. That's obviously having an impact.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that's a move towards recurring revenue. I think they dropped some numbers around the recurring revenue side in addition. So it's a big deal. So 32% is recurring revenue. So that's services contract and software subscriptions.
Yeah. It's not all software licensing, by the way. But
right.
They are sitting on $6 billion worth of deferred revenue,
yeah,
which is extraordinary.
It was a very smash up set of earnings. And I'm not surprised that things go well for them in going into the new year.
So what is interesting is that they don't break out networking and service provider and servers like they used to. They just call everything that we used to look at is just called infrastructure. And 7.5 billion of that is that. And that number's pretty static for a while now. But out of the 12.8 billion, I think we're going to be approaching a time where less than half of their revenue comes from traditional enterprise IT infrastructure. And I wonder what Cisco will look like after that.
Yeah, I just don't consider Cisco a networking company anymore.
No.
And it's which is a weird thing to say as someone who built his career on starting up in networking and building it and certainly learning Cisco products. But I think it's quite clear they're up there in the behemoth category of a conglomerate similar to what Dell's doing.
They made a really successful transition to compete with HP and Dell. And it's not I'm selling networking against HP and Dell. It's I'm selling servers and hyperconverged and application software and, you know, that sort of thing. That at $50 billion, I don't know how much money revenue Dell turns over in a year, but it's a lot more than that. But they're on the same sort of ballpark. You don't draw breath and say Cisco is small.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true.
So well done to Cisco. Well done to the employees at Cisco, who must have worked pretty hard to do that as well. So we've got a bunch of links in there to just how much it is. Even the service provider business wasn't entirely dead. They had some very limited, that continued to shrink, but not as much as was previously expected. And the final article, or the cold coffee bit at the end here, is you raised this one. The Tinder co-founders are suing the owners of the company for money, for deception.
Yeah, I just thought this was really funny. I especially thought it was entertaining just by the title. So just for the younger folks that are in the dating scene, you know, Tinder and what it provides, but basically the co-founders sued the parent company for $2 billion over deception. Hmm. So Tinder is people over deception. It's just a funny title. You know, it's part of the
everything about dating is about deception. So it's right? Really,
yeah, it's just sort of anyway. It was one of those things where, you know, I actually think there's something legit behind it, where they're trying to sue to basically protect their employees around valuations for the employees. Oh, so
they're saying that the board of directors has been deflating the price of the stocks when share employees were exercising their options, so they didn't get as much as they otherwise would have.
Right. Which is, I mean, hey, you know, they're looking out for their employees. That's great. You know, the parent company, it's this whole thing with Match Group and everything else. I guess there was some behind the scenes stuff that went on there, but it was just sort of cool to see someone that was actually stepping up and trying to do something for their employees. But I just thought the title was just hysterical in terms of Tinder deception. I mean, I guess it goes hand in hand, right?
I guess at least the founders of the company are standing up for the employees. So Ed, tell people where they can find you on the internet.
Yeah, you know, I'm just on Twitter is probably the most common, at E. Horley. Feel free to DM me. I'm happy to chat through stuff. And I've got some fun stuff that I'm doing with you guys.
That's right.
So, yeah.
We should really have talked about it by now, but you've been doing the IPv6 Buzz podcast in the community feed. And sometime in the next week or so, it should break out into its own feed. It comes out of the gestation and it'll become its own independent podcast.
Yeah, we're really excited about it. So I've been co-hosting with my good friend and colleague, Tom Cuffin and Scott Hogue, and we're all crazy IPv6 people. And so if you want to hear some news.
Yeah, you have been the IPv6 guy that I go to for quite some time now.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. But hey, yeah, it's been great fun. We're really excited to get pushed out into the main line, as it would be, and have our own show. So that our coming out party. We've got some great content lined up. I just recorded a show yesterday, so I'm pretty excited about all of that. And you know, thanks so much to the Pack of Pushers for hosting us, because it's been great so far.
And if you have a podcast in you, if you have an idea, then we are more than happy to go through a process. So we bring you on, we put you through a process, and then once you get to a certain number of podcasts published, we can start bringing you into the Packet Pushers Network. We haven't had a whole lot of success with this, but we've now set up a process where, you know, you can record a podcast and do that. That's what the community feed in our channels is all about. I'm just working on the feeds right now. Some of it, it's not entirely easy to set up. It takes a little while, but it is there. You can subscribe to it on iTunes and you can find some details around it by the time you get this feed, I hope. Fingers crossed. Thanks very much to our sponsors, interoptic.com. Go over there and check out their optics, their OEM optics that you can buy. Save a whole bunch of cash and yet still get the support that you need and you want for those in your critical environments. And also don't forget to check out ignition.packetpushers.net. That's our site where you can give us support, but you can also sign up as a free member and just get access to a bit more information. The use of the membership system isn't so we can track you. That would really suck. What we're just using that for is a way to say, you know, here, emailing list, here's stuff that we can give you that's just open to anybody. It's free. And in fact, the majority of content over there. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Network Break. If you enjoy the show, please like us on Facebook, leave a recommendation on Apple Podcasts, or share a link with your colleagues. That would really help, especially if you could go over to Apple Podcasts and leave a lovely 5-star review. That absolutely drives us up the Apple Podcast rankings and helps us find more people. As always, thanks for listening.